And we are back with episode 755 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund, again, from Washington Heights, and in the grand tradition started by Evo Terra over at Four Point Media, book died.
Oh, too soon. This is Gary, and I'm actually leading a dull life, and I'm still in Jacksonville. I was thinking about that, actually, as you mentioned that, Edmund, because, well, we talk about Wash dying, now that no one ever really made a big deal about Book dying, and perhaps that was our mistake.
Yeah, I don't want anybody to think that suddenly Alan Tudyk should be looking over his shoulder, although 2016 seems to be making people paranoid enough. But anyway. Oh, boy, yes, we are back at relatively full strength with both Edmund and Gary back. Yay! I'm vibing. Anyone else? Okay, fine. All right, but yeah, unfortunately, despite the fact that this was a relatively short holiday weekend, we do have a few in memoriam entries this week. We do have some news. We have a week's worth of news, and we have a week's worth of episodic discussion, and we'll see whether or not we get to some movie discussion later on, because we all kind of saw some of them, but not all of them, so there you go. All right, but we are going to get started with this week's news, and let's go ahead and start with something from the cable world, Gary.
Yes, when I saw this story, I was a bit surprised, but I guess I shouldn't have been, with the way that Hollywood and cable loves to recycle things. I think we actually did talk about this story about a year and a half ago. They mentioned that they were developing the Snowpiercer movie of Chris Evans fame into a television project, and we didn't hear anything about it. However, it's reared its... face once again in being announced that TNT has ordered a pilot for it, and it's going to be done by some of the same crew that have worked on the Sarah Connor Chronicles, as well as the upcoming Emerald City miniseries. So it should be interesting. It's going to be set as a prequel to the actual film about 7 years before the catastrophic disaster actually befell the Earth. And it's, I guess, the story of how the train comes to be. So it's going to be set as, I believe, in the year 2014 to begin with, and end in 2021, which is the year that the disaster happened in the movie, at least. I'm trying to think. That's about it right now. We'll have to see how it develops from there, and... the original article back over a year ago did have some talent attached to it, but the current information doesn't mention anything, so I feel it's best to err on the side of caution.
Hmm. Any thoughts on that, Edmund?
Now that we have a little more background, I mean, it's starting to make somewhat more sense. I know at the time, certainly given the original film, it seemed like such a bizarre sort of one-off project. But I suppose going back and doing the origins of how the world happened to be on this train could make a little more sense anyway.
A little, right? At least they are trying. Because otherwise I wasn't sure how exactly they were going to make it work. But there's been other movie adaptations that we've said, how is this ever going to work? 12 Monkeys.
Yes,
and
exactly.
That did perfectly fine. So, okay. More news out of the cable world, and this is news that I'm very happy about. And I'm sure that other residents of the Pacific Northwest, or those who wish they lived up there sometimes, are pretty happy with this. The original Twin Peaks full series is coming to Showtime. That's right. The third season will be debuting sometime in 2017, but beginning December 26th, that's right, it's a present. A little present every day after Christmas, just for you. The first two seasons will be airing, which was roughly 30 episodes, depending on exactly how you want to parse it out, because there were some double episodes and such. It was on back in the early 90s, very early 90s. Some of us remember from watching it in real time. But they will be available for subscribers to the network's streaming service, Showtime On Demand, and Showtime Anywhere. Yes, so of course those who are not familiar somehow with this, Twin Peaks told the story of FBI Special Agent Dale Cooper and his ongoing immersion into small town life. The show also featured Ray Wise, Alicia Witt, kind of, Warren Frost, Dana Ashbrook, Sherilyn Fenn, David Duchovny, Cheryl Lee, and a whole lot of other people.
Larfin Boyle.
That's correct. I'm wondering why her name is being left out, but anyway. The new Twin Peaks picks up 25 years after the original series. It will also feature James Belushi, Krista Bell, Robert Knepper, Michael Cera, Eddie Vedder, Amanda Seyfried, Tom Sizemore, Balthazar Getty, Naomi Watts, Laura Dern, and about 100 other people. I'm not kidding.
Yes.
Look it up. It's out there. Look, the cast list is insane. And we're all the happier for it. So, yes. Showtime also has, those who haven't seen it yet, from 1986, Blue Velvet, which featured Kyle MacLachlan, Isabella Rossellini, and Dennis Hopper, which was kind of like a proto Twin Peaks in some respects.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that's good they're releasing the old ones again, because honestly, I was too young to drink at the time, but I've always felt that a good whiskey would have helped that show immensely. So.
And a damn fine cup of coffee.
Yes.
You mentioned the pie, yes.
You might even be able to combine the two, in fact.
You know what would be a really good combination there? Supernatural and Twin Peaks, because Dean would love the pie from the Double R.
Yes.
Just saying. All right.
Yeah, well, we've already had the Supernatural Walking Dead crossover this season, so I think we can make this happen.
I think so. I think it's possible. Edmund, there's some other news from the cable world.
Yes, this is news about Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency over on BBC America. And it has, in fact, been renewed for a second season. This was announced by BBC America, saying the quirky show has hit a chord with its audience. We'll have to see later in the week if it's managing to hit that chord with John yet. And this is, of course, the show based loosely on Douglas Adams' novel of the same name, following the madcap investigations carried out by Dirk Gently with the help of his unwitting assistant, Todd, with both mysterious supernatural elements like body-jumping souls and sci-fi concepts like time travel, the show takes an insanely improbable set of circumstances and creates a compelling puzzle of the resulting dark conspiracy. This is a season 2 renewal for 10 episodes, an increase over this first season's 8. The series is continuing its current run, at least John will be continuing to let us know, and maybe some of us will catch up as things slow down a little bit in TV land as we get into the holidays.
Yes, we'll be hearing a little bit more about that next time around. Next episode. I promise, it's all connected. All right. Now we move on to some things that are in development. And speaking of Kyle MacLachlan, Legendary has acquired the Dune film and TV rights. I doubt that Kyle MacLachlan will be coming back to play Paul Atreides, but who can forget his portrayal in the David Lynch? There we go again.
Yes.
David Lynch adaptation of...
There seems to be a theme this week, yes.
Yes. Well, we even talked about this, Edmund, yes. Last time we recorded. The fact that, hey, why doesn't somebody come up with a way to do this on TV? Well... Apparently, with Dark Tower and so forth being this kind of hybrid TV movie type of thing, that's something that is definitely taking off in terms of various studios looking for their opportunity to do a kind of shared universe. Of course, everybody wants to have a cinematic universe, and, well, Dune is a pretty good place to start. So Legendary Pictures has reached an agreement with the Herbert Estate for the film and TV rights to the classic novel. So there's very little details right now, but they will be turning the novel series into a film franchise with the hopes of it becoming a full-on saga similar to Star Wars or Star Trek. The agreement calls for the development and production of possible film and television projects for a global audience. For those who have been under a rock since the 1960s, the novel tells the story of Paul Atreides, whose family accepts control of the planet Arrakis, a desert world which is the sole producer of an incredibly valuable spice. Hence, the world is heavily contested by all the galaxy's ruling families. After his family is betrayed, Paul goes on a journey of religion, politics, and communing with nature, as he realizes his true potential and leads a rebellion to retake control of the world. And that leaves an awful lot out, to say the least. Dune is, as it says right here, has been considered for many the holy grail of science fiction film projects because, quite frankly, nobody's really done it well. David Lynch, as I just mentioned a little while ago, really tried in the 80s, didn't quite catch on. There was, I can never say his name, Alejandro...
Jodorowsky.
Thank you. I recognize it on sight. I cannot pronounce it. Infamously tried in the 1970s, I believe, to put it together, and there is in fact a whole movie about that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually quite fun to watch because as a fan, you just sit back and think, boy, if they could have made this work.
Yeah, the thing that's always amused me about that, having seen some of the films that Jodorowsky did actually produce in the 70s, if people thought the Lynch version was strange and over the top, I mean, his would have been that times about 10 if it had actually been made.
That's right. So, okay. And of course, there was the sci-fi miniseries in the early 2000s, which is not bad, but was clearly lower budget than probably people were looking for. Seriously, they want to make this a true big budget type of film thing. So, yeah, it could be very interesting to see exactly how far they want to take this. And, you know, how are they going to... Once again, the big trouble here is trying to take a very dense novel and boil it down to a film.
Yeah.
An introductory film, shall we say. So how they managed to do that, how they managed to approach it, is all to be determined. But I'm excited. Let's have somebody else take another stab at this. Yeah. Someone's got to get it right sooner or later.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, Gary, speaking of someone taking another stab at a shared universe, or a...
You're absolutely right. I couldn't something. Wait to bite into this story. What we're talking about is it's recently been announced that Anne Rice will be coming to television with The Vampire Chronicles. She recently announced on Facebook that she has regained the theatrical rights to her vampire series, including fan favorites Interview with a Vampire, as well as the Vampire Lestat books. She's planning to begin work on an adaptation with her son. And her dream, as she says, is to produce the highest quality television series for Lestat, Louis, Armand, Marius, and the entire tribe. In this new golden age of television, this series is the way to let me tell my entire story of how the vampires unfold. My son and I will be developing the pilot script and an outline for the open-ended series, faithfully presenting Lestat's story as it's told in the books. We are likely planning to begin with the vampire Lestat and move on from there. For people that aren't familiar with this series at all, it started back in 1976 with the first book, Interview with a Vampire, and has since gone on to 12 novels. Jeez, I stopped somewhere around 8. I'm going to have to look again. At one time, Universal Pictures and Imagine Entertainment did have the rights, and they finally passed at this point. Rice also wrote about this upcoming series that over the years, a lot of fans have told her how much she wants to see a Game of Thrones-style faithfully rendering of this material, and that they want it to remain in her control. She says, "I've heard you, I've always heard you, and this is what I want, and this is what you want. I'm filled with optimism about the future for my beloved Brad Prince." So, the 12th novel is due to be released probably this week as you're hearing this recording. So, very interesting. I definitely have to say, you know, both cable TV and, you know, some of the pay-per-view stations and things of that nature are definitely had the censor shackles taken off them. And I feel this is definitely a property where that type of intellectual freedom, if you will definitely benefit the storyline. Even in the movies, sometimes these stories seem shackled to me. And if you do enjoy it, I'm sure you will like this idea that... you know, the chains are coming off, and it'll finally see the true light of day.
It would be nice to see them do more with it. I thought that the movie with Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise back in the 90s was pretty good. It was a good start, and then they just never really capitalized on that the way that I thought that they would. Mm-hmm. So maybe giving that another look, another restart, would be a good idea. And I'm a little bit wary of Anne Rice being the one behind it. She has a tendency to kind of come and go when it comes to her embracing her own property. She'll just kind of decide it's all over with and she wants to go and do something else for a while, and then she'll come back to it, and it never quite seems like there's a consistency there, but I'm sure there are some who would disagree with that.
Well, as I read that, she's doing the outline. And the pilot. She didn't mention that she's going to be doing the ongoing writing with it. So maybe that might be our safety valve. So
it might be. Yeah, let some other people also inject some of their aesthetic into it, so to speak. But we shall see. We shall see. At least it's going somewhere instead of just dying on the vine, so to speak. All right. Let's see then. Moving over to the comic book world.
Yes, and some might be surprised this is over in the comic book world, but this is news of a sequel to, of course, the classic fantasy film The Dark Crystal, from, of course, came out way back in 1982 from Jim Henson and Frank Oz. There has been long rumored talk of a possible sequel, and we now know that the fans are finally going to get to see what happens next in a 12-issue comic from Boom Studios entitled The Power of the Dark Crystal. This is according to The Hollywood Reporter. The comic will be based on a screenplay for an unproduced sequel written by the original film's writer, David O'Dell, with help from Annette O'Dell and Craig Pierce. It's been adapted into comic form by Cy Spurrier, who created The Spire, with artists Kelly and Nicole Matthews. This follows over 10 years of attempts to get a film sequel done. Jim Henson Company sold the ownership after they sold the ownership to Disney in 2005. They tried to get something going, but as happens, all the development basically ground to a halt. At this point, the Henson Company is building on the partnership that they had established with comics publisher Arkea, which is now carrying over to Boom Studios, which has acquired Arkea as one of their imprints. Certainly all of the original people are involved. Lisa Henson, the president and CEO of Jim Henson Company, is basically saying that the creativity that went into writing and designing the film was such that we wanted our fans to be able to see and enjoy it now through the comic book medium, and that they are very proud of the story. So, good news for fans of The Dark Crystal, and at least this is a case. Speaking of stuff dying on the vine, John, there at least will be something to pluck from this one.
Indeed, I felt that was probably yes, in at least some similar vein to what we were just talking about. All right. Moving over to the manga or anime world, we actually have some anime news this time around. Now is around the time, and there's been a lot of surprising announcements lately. I only picked a couple of them. If you want to hear the full gamut, that I'm sure you will over the next couple of weeks, you can go over and listen to Anime Jam Session, our friends over at the VOG Network. I actually just was hanging out with them last night. So, they were already talking about how much they need to add to their news segment this coming week. But at any rate, we do have a few things here on our list, just for our own happiness. Mobile Suit Gundam Thunderbolt returns for Season 2. That's right, the successful first season, after a successful first season, Mobile Suit Gundam Thunderbolt will return in 2017 for Season 2. Based on the manga, this story is set during the original Gundam series, UC-0079 timeline. The series follows the battles between two ace pilots in the Thunderbolt sector of space, featuring a heavy jazz score. The first season released its final episode in April of 2016. The tagline featured in the trailer translates as, "The war is not over yet." So, more jazz, more giant mech action, and quite a bit of character conflict. Exactly what you expect from the Gundam franchise. So, yeah.
Yeah, very nice.
Sounds like a lot of fun. I know that I need to get caught up on that one because I've heard a lot of great things about it. So everyone keeps on telling me that franchise is one that I could probably sink my teeth into and it would take me forever to get through. So, but at any rate, there's just so much out there, including what we're about to talk about.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. But yeah, Mobile Suit Gundam is I'm in the same boat as you, John. It's one that I've thought about trying to get into. And I guess I actually had not realized the jazz angle, but that's certainly an incentive now. This is news that reminds me of something else that I need to catch up on. And this is news about the Code Geass anime. This was during the 10th anniversary event for the anime. It was announced that a new production, a new season is in production now. Lelouch will be starring in the new anime, this will be a sequel set years after Zero Requiem, the final events of the anime's second season. Director of the previous anime has confirmed that it will be a sequel, actual details about the format have yet to be revealed. They will, in addition, as I just mentioned, mentioned, this was 10 years ago, even though I've been catching up with it more recently. There will be three compilation films of the previous animes, which we'll be releasing in January of 2017, and will contain new audio. This is an anime that I'm about halfway through the second season, kind of let it drop with other stuff going on, but this is certainly a major incentive to finish that up. And I'm very happy that the article decided not to actually spoil those final events of the second season for me. But Code Geass, one of the sociological parts of it which really amused me was having this future where Japan has been taken over by a apparently revived British Empire, which I always found quite amusing, as both Japan and England being the two island nations with who tried to extend, who are, in the case of Britain, certainly did extend their empire over much of the world, and Japan tried to do the same in the Pacific, and had their ambitions eventually curtailed. And I always felt like Code Geass was a way for Japan to relive some of that past imperial glory, or attempt to. I will be quite interested to see both what actually happened at the end of the second season and what they're coming up with next.
Yeah, I'm glad that they're doing the compilation films. That's probably the best way for me to actually get into this one, because it was one that's been on my list, and I figured I always had plenty of time. Little did I know.
Yes.
But there we are. All right. Speaking of things that are coming back for a third season, see, there's lots that's actually coming together very nicely in terms of a narrative here. Dirk Gently would be proud. In the gaming world, Telltale's The Walking Dead: A New Frontier has a release date. That's right, the third season of The Walking Dead game will be starting on December 20th, 2016. So just in time for the holidays.
Yay!
Imagine that.
Yes. As usual, the game will be available for PC, Xbox One, PlayStation 4 gamers as digital download, but console gamers will also be able to purchase a disc-based version that will unlock all the content as it becomes available. Yes, here is the official synopsis from Telltale. When family is all you have left, how far will you go to protect it? 4 years after society was ripped apart by undead hands, pockets of civilization emerge from the chaos, but at what cost? Can the living be trusted with this new frontier? As Javier, a young man determined to find the family taken from him, you meet a young girl who has experienced her own unimaginable loss. Her name is Clementine, and your fates are bound together in a story where every choice you make could be your last.
Hmm.
So yes, Clementine is coming back from the first two seasons. So... yes, very much looking forward to that. I really enjoy the Telltale games. I'm in the middle of the Batman one that's out right now. They just released episode 4, so yeah, that one's a really good one, and I do recommend it. And I also recommend the Walking Dead games. So there you go. Next on their list, we have some movie news. Gary?
Yes, it's been recently announced that... Didn't they have one already? Anyway, what we're talking about is the... that Mortal Kombat is going to be getting a movie reboot. They recently announced that they've secured a director. Simon McCoy will be the director. And if you don't know his name immediately, you might not, but you've seen his work. He's primarily been a commercial director, doing a lot of PlayStation, Halo, as well as Beats by Dre commercials. And they're pulling out the chair for him to direct this. They feel that they... let me rephrase that. The producer of the movie wants to go back to some more of the horror elements of the Mortal Kombat mythology, and definitely make it a little bit darker than we've seen in the past. The new movie is said to center around a seemingly harmless guy who realizes his potential when he's caught in the middle of a cross-dimensional battle between the warriors of Earth and the monsters of Outworld. In order to stop total destruction, he must win the martial arts tournament known as Mortal Kombat. The new film is supposed to be darker. Brutally realistic martial arts are supposed to be employed. And it might not have a techno soundtrack, so we'll just have to let that go by the wayside. But as more information becomes available, we'll, of course, hit you with it. So,
man, I was so looking forward to another techno soundtrack, too. Okay, interesting. Edmund.
We have more directorial news for Deadpool 2. Of course, well, there had been the news that the original director, or the man who was, he wasn't actually formally signed, but Tim Miller, who was slated to helm that film, had exited the project, presumably because of creative differences with Ryan Reynolds. And we now have David Leitch stepping up, who was the guy behind John Wick, so certainly very experienced with doing quite good action action movie stuff. And at yeah, at this point, so we now have a director. He is. The actual script, which was being developed by the original director, along with Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick, and it's still a little bit up in the air exactly how far along they were and where that stands, but at least things are moving forward, and I think, given Mr. Reynolds' track record so far with this project, I'm feeling cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I know we've talked about this before. I think that it's taking definitely a wait-and-see approach because it's still not clear to me exactly where the success of that movie necessarily rests. I think that as much as Ryan Reynolds would like to believe that it was all on his shoulders, or mostly on his shoulders, I do feel like it was more of a combination effort, and it'll be interesting to see what happens when they try to kind of take what was lightning in a bottle and try and force a sequel out of it instead of just letting it kind of happen.
Yeah.
But anyhow, Gary, speaking of John Wick directors.
Yeah, it seems, gosh, they're really getting out of the house. Yeah, and I will just pre-advance by, I don't believe this is a real thing because there can be only one, but I'll report this news anyway. What I'm talking about is the proposed Highlander reboot. They've announced that a director has been signed, Chad Stahelski, the other half of the John Wick directorial team has been signed to do this. They did say that they wanted a little bit more of a shift to what we've seen in the past with some of the Highlander properties. They really want to bring back more of the original 1986 film to the franchise with a lot more strong swordplay and a little bit less fighting action, but more swordplay. They feel that that will those evocative sort of medieval style sword scenes will sort of better capture the je ne sais quoi of the series. So we'll have to keep you updated with any more news. There has not been a writer attached to this yet, and nor what time frame or sequences they might hop through as the original one did. So if you're looking forward to a new one, that's great. If you don't think any more could exist, I'm right there with you. So we'll just keep you up to date as we hear more.
Yeah, I guess I'd rather if they were going to try and make an updated version versus trying to continue, because the continuations just got worse and worse, in my opinion.
Aliens.
Yeah, they started there and it just kept going. Anyhow. But I will say that that may be a film that it kind of needs everything that exists in the cheesy 80s version in order to survive. I don't know. We'll find out. This next piece of information here from the movie news is I thought it was about something else at first because when you hear the title, you automatically think of something different. Mortal Engines movie coming in December of 2018. Now, everybody out in the audience, raise your hands if when you heard Mortal Engines, you immediately thought Mortal Instruments. So did I.
Yes.
Sadly, no, we're not seeing more out of that franchise, it seems. But Universal and MRC announced that the Mortal Engines movie is coming to theaters on December 14th, 2018. Peter Jackson and Fran Walsh are making the movie based on the award-winning book series of the same name by British author Philip Reeve. Jackson and Walsh have been involved with the project for several years, having optioned the rights from Scholastic. They have co-written the screenplay with collaborator Philippa Boyens. Ken Kamens, Jackson, Walsh, and Boyens' longtime manager brought the project to MRC. They're co-financing the film. Universal will also serve as distributor. Production slated to begin where else? In New Zealand in spring 2017.
Of course.
Let's see here. Can we get any type of explanation? Oh, here it is down here. Mortal Engines is set in a world many thousands of years in the future. Earth cities now roam the globe on huge wheels, devouring each other in a struggle for ever-diminishing resources. On one of these massive traction cities, Tom Natsworthy has an unexpected encounter with a mysterious young woman from the Outlands who will change the course of his life forever. As typically happens.
Of course.
Of course. So there you go. Apparently it is a four-book series, Mortal Engines, Predator's Gold, Infernal Devices, and A Darkling Plane. So there you go.
Yeah, I've got to say, just that, I mean, nothing specific, but in terms of that general description of the setting and this book cover they're showing here, I'm getting a bit of a Nausicaa vibe from that, the classic Ghibli, you know, their first big anime. But in terms of that that sort of dystopian future world with a young heroine helping presumably bring things together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does seem to have a little bit of that, and mix that with some steampunk.
Well, of course, yes.
Yes. Let's see here. That means that we can move over to casting news.
That's good, Bell.
Yeah.
Yeah, the bell got upgraded in the move.
I can tell.
Yeah. Edmund, you have the first piece here.
Yes, this is more news from the Black Panther production. Of course, the movie is not scheduled for release until 2018, but the cast is pretty impressive already, but it just got a little more impressive-ier, as Angela Bassett has now joined up to play Ramonda, T'Challa's mother and the widow of King T'Chaka. And of course, this is the MCU, so that is pretty much all I can tell you, other than we probably did mention this previously, but Ryan Coogler, the director of Fruitvale Station last year, and Creed more recently, has been brought on board to direct. So I think a pretty good get, both in the mother and widow department and the director department.
There you go. Always good to see the progress being made on MCU films, especially since they keep knocking them out of the park.
Yes.
Next, we have some news coming out of Pacific Rim 2. Legendary Entertainment has tapped Chinese action film star Zhang Jin for Pacific Rim 2, joining Jin Shang, John Boyega, Scott Eastwood, and Kaylee Spaney. Other Chinese actors in the sequel include an awful lot of them, actually. And that has begun filming in Australia. Stephen S. DeKnight is directing, based, of course, on Guillermo del Toro's original film. So it looks like there's going to be a much more international cast. Probably not surprising, considering some of the other news items we've had over the last year regarding the massive shift we've seen towards courting the Chinese film industry and film audience. Not surprisingly, it kind of makes sense that there would be a fairly heavy Asian influence on these films, considering what they're clearly based upon. Though I wouldn't pick China, but anyway.
Yeah, well, we've gone over that quite a bit previously.
We may have. The film is going to be released, at least this is what everybody is crossing their fingers for. It's going to be released on February 23rd, 2018, around the world, with the exception of China. Who knows exactly where what's going on with that. But yes, that's all it really has to say about that particular casting choice. It's just interesting to see the number of Chinese actors that they have involved in this production. We'll have to see where they're going with that. Gary, you have some news regarding finally some casting news about something that probably we should have heard about long before now.
You would think so, and I guess to go further with our Chinese casting announcement that you previously made, they've announced the first cast member for the Star Trek Discovery series. They pulled out what I consider to be reasonably big guns with this one, and they announced that Michelle Yeoh of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon fame has joined the cast, and I believe she's going to be I take that back. We don't know what role she's going to play. Now, they have Bryan Singer had teased us originally and mentioned that the main character of the series will not be the captain, as is somewhat traditional with Star Trek series, but I believe the first officer is going to be the primary focus of the series. So whether Michelle Yeoh will be captain or first officer, we don't know yet. As we mentioned in, a while ago, they did push the premiere date from January to May of 2017 for a 13-episode order. And it will run exclusively on the CBS's All Access Network streaming service, although I think they might tease us with the first episode.
Yes.
Other than that, not much more has been revealed. It's still in development, and Nicholas Meyer really is still very much attached to the series, but will not say anything. So we have our first little glimmer, and I'm sure the fan fiction is already being written with this sole announcement. So we'll have to wait and see what other tidbits they throw our way before May.
Well, there you go. Yeah, there's still a lot of information for us to get regarding the actual casting of people in Star Trek Discovery. This is about as much as we've heard, so there you go. It's at least something, right?
Yeah.
That's the way I look at it. All right. That is it then for our regular news segment. That means that we are going to go ahead and wrap up with, unfortunately, our In Memoriam section. And Edmund, why don't you get us started here?
Certainly. As I did briefly report at the top of the show, for those who have not heard yet, Ron Glass, who first came to prominence playing Detective Ron Harris on Barney Miller, and in one of those odd bits of synchronicity, I actually happened to catch a couple of episodes of Barney Miller earlier this week as I was channel surfing, came upon it and hadn't seen it in quite some time, and was just reminded of what a wonderful sitcom it was, and for a show that was basically had one rather pokey set of this rundown detective's room. They did so, you know, with that amazing cast, Hal Linden and Ron Glass as the detective, and all of their coworkers. It was a classic case of wonderful acting and wonderful writing. Ron Glass was in fact nominated for an Emmy for that show, has went on to many other appearances on things like Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., also on Friends. I did find it interesting how different outlets chose to highlight different parts of his career in their obituaries, but of course for our audience, probably best known for playing Shepherd Book on Firefly and the follow-up film Serenity. He was quite a presence as the Good Shepherd, providing the crew with sage advice and wisdom, which was a reflection of his private life. He was a leader in the California Buddhist community and served as a member of Soka Gakkai International. Naturally, there were many condolences from across the industry, but especially from his fellow cast members and Joss Whedon himself, who said that Ron got there with grace, humor, and enormous heart. He was, among so many other things, my shepherd. Raise appropriately a glass. Rest, Ron. Also, Nathan Fillion, Alan Tudyk, also weighing in, certainly many of Shepherd Book's lines were used in memoriam, but I think the one that I felt was particularly appropriate was his line, "I don't care what you believe, just believe it." This has been a brutal year, this was a particularly rough one to have come right at the end as we head into the holiday season. But rest in peace, Ron Glass, and at least we still have all of his wonderful work to remember.
Yeah, I don't even know what to add other than to think that, you know, we have been kind of hit with a lot of major losses from all of our respective formative fandoms this year. I mean, Rickman from Harry Potter, Nimoy, of course, Doyle from Babylon 5, now we've got Ron Glass. It just seems like it keeps hitting again and again, so... Yeah, it's been a real rough one, to say the least. Gary, you have anything you want to add?
Just to espouse the man's talent, he very much always played the straight man, but would throw the zingers out. And his timing, whether it was on Firefly or Barney Miller, always was just so well done. And he would just make you crack up no matter what he had to say. And whoever he played with, you always got the sense that he was almost working for them, because it was never a scene while he was definitely in it, it never seemed like he was trying to ever hog a scene or anything like that. He was just trying to contribute and did so wonderfully.
Yeah, I think that's really a good way to describe it and a good good observation. So yeah, I don't think any of us expected that we'd be losing anyone from the Firefly crew, from the Serenity, anytime soon. But yeah, there we are. Godspeed, Mr. Glass. Gary, we have one more.
Yeah, we, as we said, 2016 is one vicious year. And some of our some of the people that I'm, you know, might not, of our listeners might not know this guy that well, but I'm going to talk about him a little bit, and I'm going to skip half of the memorial text that we got on him, because much as Edmund said, it is interesting what people choose to focus on, and sometimes it just doesn't do the man justice. We're talking about Rob Thornton. He's primarily known for special effects, and he, I guess, for the mainstream audience, he's known for Star Trek. He did about 24 to 25 episodes of Enterprise, as well as Voyager, and won an Emmy for the Voyager crash scene from the episode Timeless. But he was so much more than that. He worked on Blake 7, you know, back in the 70s, doing, you know, real models. And then when he, as well as Doctor Who, then when this guy Joe Straczynski showed up and wanted to do this show, but he had to do it on the cheap. There was no way he could compete with Star Trek's $1 million an episode budget. It just couldn't be done. So he and Ron got together and they talked about it. Ron had recently bought an Amiga 1000 and with this program called Video Toaster, and he thought that he could actually do CGI effects. This was groundbreaking. Prior to Ron's work, CGI special effects amounted to line drawings. If you want to think of Luke's display on as he was going down the tunnel in the first Star Wars movie, with just the lines and the little squares, that's all CGI ever was before Ron Thornton. He advanced the medium tremendously. He made Babylon 5 a cost-efficient film, and CGI not only was cheaper than filming models, but it allowed you, Ron showed how it could do shots that weren't possible with traditional camera and model work. Continuous shots that would circle around a station that weren't possible when a model would be held up with a pole. He started this whole idea of, you know, texturing these CGI models so that they would appear much more realistic, that they weren't just a color or a shade. He started the first interactive television show when he worked on Captain Power and the Soldiers of the Future, when you could take your toy and shoot off sections of the CGI characters that he had created on the screens. As I said, he also worked on, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I'm thinking that's where the graph came from. Anyway, as well as the remaster of Star Trek: The Motion Picture and Spaceballs as well for you Mel Brooks fans. He, in so many ways, pioneered CGI. Now it's one of the popular programs is Lightwave, and they consider him to be the father of this whole sort of development. So while, you know, Lucasfilm and Industrial Lights and Magic may get a lot of kudos for their model work, this really is the guy who, you know, made CGI happen, and I don't think he gets enough recognition. But that being said, he was an innovator. And it's just, and we're all benefiting to this day for the courage that he took to get into this new foundling field and make it work.
Yeah, it's, like you said, things that are left out. I guess that's one of those particular ones where we definitely know that name so much more than some other people do because of our collective Babylon 5 fandom, but a huge loss to that entire industry, really, for everything that he brought to it. And I know you probably feel exactly the same way, and I know, Edmund, you probably would agree that even today, especially with science fiction, you watch a CGI shot and you can see all the fingerprints of what he did with Trek and Babylon 5.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mostly Babylon 5. I mean, because we know those tracking shots like the back of our heads. So.
Oh yeah, and there's some, you know, there's CGI forums online, and I guess this gets to be so geeky that, you know, mainstream media won't pick it up. But oh yeah, I mean, everybody was, you know, people who are, you know, currently working on, you know, big films, whether it be the Star Wars films or several other science fiction films, you know, just were posting to their forums on, you know, what a great guy he was, how you know, he'd always listen to you, that he was always, you know, willing to put input. And even though he was semi-retired at this point, you know, he'd still consult with people all the time. And it was just, you know, was one of those people, you could not find a bad word said. Mm-hmm. So, and I think I remember we interviewed him once on the Babylon podcast, and he was hilarious. Absolutely, I was falling off my seat as, you know, as he was talking. So, you know, very much a, you know, a down to earth, nice guy who just, you know, loves what he was doing.
Yeah, and I know one of the stories which I had heard before, but not there was a lot of detail, but not with quite this specificity. But apparently as JMS was pitching Babylon 5. It was the clip that Ron came up with to illustrate just what the CGI could do was really critical in getting the executives on board with this concept that yes they really could do this that much cheaper, you know, magnitudes cheaper than what Star Trek was doing, and it wasn't just showing that it could be done cheaply, but that it was this extraordinary shot that as you said, Gary, was something that would not have been possible with models anyway. So it was you know, both efficiency and creativity helping to make sure one of our favorite shows ever came to be.
I hate to say it that we're kind of closing this one off on a little bit of a downer, but we are. It is unfortunately something that we are all too used to this year, and I'm hoping that, you know what, let's just get it done this year. Maybe next year we don't have it quite as much, but okay.
And just one thing I'd like to say, you know, in a way we are all grateful because these were all public people who, you know, produce work for us to see, and all their great work ideas, they all live on. So it's not, you know, while they're gone, we can still pop in a DVD or stream something and still sit there and be in awe.
Yes, indeed. I agree. All right, what we're going to do then is wrap this one up. We will come back next time with a bit of episodic discussion, to say the least. We had quite a bit the week before the holiday hit. So we'll just get right into that when we come back next time. So until then.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google+, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time, watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.